Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Ben Hunter, and we are across from Christina Olsen, who has come to talk about her new novel, Shell. Shall I say, gorgeous hardcover novel, Shell.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We've all had a look at it, because this is a book that outside of the sitting in your garret and writing your book and in isolation, the book world's going nuts about. The word has just been going around booksellers, and so without you knowing it, there's already buzz about your book.
That's a bit scary.
Yeah, but a book that booksellers love is
a good book.
Is a book that's going to be sold well everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's reassuring, isn't it? Really, after 5 years of sitting in the garret.
Yeah.
That actually might get read by more than a half a dozen people and your mother. Yeah.
Well, it's in the front of every shop, and I can tell you because I went to them all.
That's fantastic. I'm going to go look at them myself.
Yeah. Well, the other aspect of this is that it is sublime. So, well done you.
Oh, thank you. You mean the writing?
Yes.
Oh, goodness.
Very well crafted.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a relief to hear. Yeah. I mean, from people like you.
Well, you've got so much in this book, and we should sort of give readers a sense of what's going on. Do you have a tiny little spiel that you give about when you're trying to sell this book to people or tell people what you've written?
I say that it's set in the mid-60s, in a particular year that I found fascinating, 1965, against but not about the building of the Opera House and Australia going into the Vietnam War and reintroducing conscription for 20-year-old men. It was, watershed years, I think, in Australia around that time. The old was giving way to the new. Certainly the old male part of Australia was being challenged by the new. And elsewhere in the world, of course, it was everything was being questioned by the young, gender and race and politics. But in Australia, of course, we're always a little bit behind that. And in 65, there we were building this sublime building at one end of, the city, this extraordinary thing, this shape was rising on Bennelong Point. At the other end of Macquarie Street, we were busy planning to send 20-year-old men away to a war in a place very few of them had ever heard of. It seemed to me that, what kind of place does this? What kind of country were we then? And is it possible we are still? That can hold those two things in its collective head at the same time. So, and I wanted to see it through the eyes of someone who wasn't Australian, I guess, mostly. So hence...
Which is our history, really, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And still is. Yeah. And it goes on that way. Mm. So nothing's changed in that way. And I must say, nothing much has changed politically and socially either.
So when you say you took 5 years, so in the 5 years you've been writing, the political situation in Australia has kind of gotten, in my mind, worse rather than better.
Yes.
Did that affect the writing of the book at all, in the sense that you had more scope? Because they kept making it worse. You had more room to move.
It is fun for writers when that sort of happens around you. Yeah. Not in your own private life, of course, but on the page, of course it does. It gives some more tension, if you like. Mm. You've got more to play with. But for a long time, my head was just in that era, trying to see it through the eyes of these characters. But what I did do was I did things like go back to Lucky Country and Donald Horne, mm-hmm. who I adore, and to see what he was saying then. And then in the update he did to the book 10 years ago or so. And really there it was, and he suggested this as well, that in fact a lot of the things in the rhetoric of the time, this was still around in the 90s and the 2000s here, things about the way we see community here, the way we, the call to the Australian people, as if we are this one homogenous mass and not this millions and millions of small, discrete villages. Mm. And certainly Tony Abbott made that one of his lines, and it's been picked up by every Prime Minister since, this call to the Australian people and their values, as if to not be amongst that, you are somehow disabled.
Mm. So it's going right now, like it's happening again.
Absolutely, right in a really shocking way, I think, in terms of what it's calling for and the attitudes it's calling to.
Yeah. And also, I remember growing up and the idea of Vietnam War and the anti-war bit was in. So in the 80s and the 90s, largely in the 80s, it kind of, war wasn't good. yeah, it was considered that, so there were plays that were talking about the war in ways which, you know, that Gallipoli and that wasn't a great thing.
Yes.
And then you hit the sort of Howard years and the Gallipoli myth starts to come back.
Yes.
Very strongly.
Yes.
And this sense of our war dead being special, more special than other people's war dead, and our diggers being better soldiers than other soldiers, and this garbage that spills
shocking
out. And yeah, you know, when it's interesting to read a book like this, which brings you boom, straight back to that period where no one knew what Vietnam was.
No, there's so many people still. I mean, interestingly, even overseas, when this book was being sold to the UK, people were saying, didn't even know Australia went to Vietnam. Australia went to Vietnam. This whole chunk of our history, which I think informed many of the ways we see things still, just wasn't seen outside Australia.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means about other places or whether that says more about us and how we were not vocal enough about what was happening here. I'm not sure. But yes, I mean, the whole you know, myth of Gallipoli still really disturbs me in terms of even where we enact it on the shores of this place.
Yeah.
That is sacred to another culture because of their own war dead and their own shocking losses. Mm. And yet we young people flock to it. I was very disturbed by that.
What was interesting was the way in which you display in Sydney. Have you lived in Sydney for a long periods of time? Or
no,
always
I haven't.
From afar?
I haven't. My daughter was at NIDA here in the 90s, and so I would come for long periods to see her shows and to see her for weeks at a time, perhaps. And I have a brother who lives in Newtown. I visit him, and I'd come through Sydney to see friends and to go to Varuna up in the Blue Mountains and spend bits of time here. But no, in fact, the Opera House had never been on my radar, particularly even when I came to visit Zoe. She was either at Coogee or Kensington, and I would go straight out there. When I went to the city, I don't think, you know, it really just wasn't, you know, on my horizon, so to speak. And I would never have chosen. I mean, I really believe that, you know, the subject chooses you as a writer. It's not the other way around.
Well, there's a very interesting author note at the end where you sort of describe all these bits coalescing together. There's the story of your mother. There's your ancestry in Sweden. And the outsider's view and the special way in which Utzon brought his culture into the middle of our harbour. You know, all these different things come in, and then you're stuck in the middle of a city that's not yours. But I don't know about you, Ben, but you know, it is the Sydney I know. Like I've been raised across the harbour from it, and you know, and it's my harbour.
That's a relief. That's a great relief.
But at the same time, John, reading these pages has welcomed me to look at this, particularly that stretch along Bennelong and that that building with just completely opened eyes.
That's very moving for me to hear.
Because we John and I are lucky enough to grow up around here. And when, you know, every time I for a long time I've just dreaded Circular Quay as a place. I see is ferries and tourists and buskers and Ugg boots boutiques.
Yes.
And I don't see this incredible body of water, this incredible sky, this building that just sweeps up and arcs and captures the imagination, this kind of beautifully organic structure that perfectly contrasts the grand mechanical structure of the bridge. They're just the perfect yin and yang, these two things. And I was just oblivious to that.
Well, that's great to hear. It was kind of great to hear. But, you know, I think that was the thing in the 60s that people were afraid of seeing. Most Australia, the Australians who were, you know, really confronted by the building, I think was confronted by those things in themselves, that, you know, our own capacity for grandeur and humility at the same time. All those things at the Opera House, they could see were coming up on Bennelong Point, were the things that they were trying to push down themselves. So kind of, in a way, it wasn't a surprise to me that Utzon was dealt the blows he was.
I get the feeling that you, in some of the ways in which you write this, you're sitting there like a painter. Like, and you're really, you're seeing it as an image, and you're just trying to get the beauty of it down, like the sunsets, the water, the lowering clouds. Like there's a whole range of beautiful descriptions within this book. And I felt you're sitting there with an easel rather than a typewriter.
Well, it's interesting because I hadn't seen it that way before, but certainly with this book especially, I really was working at sentence level.
Mm-hmm.
That's really where I was finding meaning, was at that sentence level. And it is like a brushstroke, if you like, a sentence.
There's a bit in Christina Stead's, I think it's a puzzle-headed girl, when she talks about putting a book together like a painting. With
is there? Dance. I must read that. I haven't read that.
But, you know, what I do, I don't know whether you're a fan of Christina Stead, but I get the For Love Alone, and I felt like I need to go back and read that again.
Oh, yeah, well, same, absolutely. Yeah. There were some books that I didn't want to read again because I didn't want anything to bleed through too much, and that was one of them. But certainly the character of Constance in the book is a little homage to Christina. I use the same initials for her name, but lots of people haven't picked it up, which is good in a way.
Yeah. But there are so many stories going on in this book. There's so many different things happening. You've got the journalist who is in a man's world and attempting to carve out a spot for herself and to write about things from her perspective and to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
You've got an artist coming out from Scandinavia who is, you know, months in Australia and really trying to work it out. And some of the observations of how Australian men sit around and how they talk to each other from that outsider's perspective are gold.
Mm. Are they? Oh, good. Well, a couple of them, especially a couple of the scenes of the workers having lunch. I really wanted the book to be a paean of praise to working men and women, actually, because they are noble in so many ways. And I don't want that to sound sentimental, but I've got lots of working men in my family. My father was an electrical engineer, but he worked like a working man, and my brothers certainly do. And I see how they work and what their ethic is.
Mm.
And sometimes that ethic is dissed a great deal. But so I didn't want to make them, you know, noble savages or anything. But anyway, when I was trying to pull the dialogue log together, it didn't seem too difficult for me because of the people I'd had around me. But I did show it to my partner who'd been a builder. He's not any longer, but he'd spent a lot of time on building sites. And I read him out one night. I was pretty pleased with it. And he said, "Oh, it's not nearly strong enough."
More swearing.
Yes, absolutely. Much more extreme swearing. Because I thought it was, you know, fairly rough. No, no. And so I had to make little changes.
You remind me, when I was reading this, there was an article. They're building new buildings at Broadway, and there's this wonderful brick structure that has these curving bricks, and they're interviewing this bricklayer up on there doing it. And the warmth and the passion that he had, I actually felt tears coming to my eyes watching this. It was only a tiny snippet, but this guy up there, he's a bricklayer only, but he's part of the building. Like he feels he's done this bit, and he has to get it exactly right to be a part of this building, and the pride that he had showing off this section just killed me.
It would, me as well. I mean, there was a lot of, in the research I did, a lot of evidence of that, exactly that kind of sentiment.
You imagine driving past and going, "I did that. Yeah, I'm part of that."
Extraordinary. Yeah. And people still do that. And even now, just people who I don't know, I learn secondhand that people will report back to me and say, "Oh, I know a person who did work on the Opera House," and they feel incredibly attached to the building, even though they live in Brisbane or Perth or wherever else. Their hands are on it.
Yeah.
And they feel very much that they've left some of themselves there.
It reminds me, I mean, as Ben was saying earlier, the effect that the Opera House has had on me since reading it, just seeing the damn thing. You know, I mean, I was heading towards the tunnel and that, and went across the bridge.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, now, I mean, I've gone from being a person who didn't really, you know, pay much attention to, whenever I'm in Sydney, I have to. I'm a walker anyway, but I walk around and around and look at it in different lights and look at, you know, crouch down and see it from different angles and watch the way other people interact. Because that you do, you interact with that building.
Mm.
It's, I mean, you know, David Malouf says this thing about architecture being the art that can change things the most. You plonk a significant building down on a corner anywhere and people will change their behaviour. If it's a particular kind of building, it'll change the way things happen. And, I mean, it's clearly the case with the
That whole section of the harbour is a different place. Mm. When you go anywhere else in the harbour, and you've got one harbour, and you go anywhere near that, anywhere in sight of that building, and it's another harbour.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely, it's true. It's almost
catching
the
I love catching the ferry past it, catching the Manly ferry and coming towards it. It's just worth it.
There's nothing else, really. There's just you on the ferry and that building and watching it get bigger and bigger as it comes. Like, yeah, it's like I never get tired of it. Extraordinary.
Can you tell me about when it took 5 years and you say you've been writing it at sentence level? It feels to me like it feels light when I read it, but being a writer, I kind of know how difficult it is to do that.
Yes.
Yeah. And so how many times did you write the story down in one way and then rewrite it? I mean, how many times did you actually restructure it or was it just rewrite?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how I do it. You know, a first draft to me is never just, you know, run it off. That's where it all happens for me is the first draft. And I do a lot of it in longhand and I do a lot of it in pieces. It depends on the character and the thematic content, which I never really know until I'm halfway into it. I don't know. Because for me, it's always about a question. It's never because I know anything. It's because I don't know. So I'm trying to work out.
What was the question that drove you in this?
Part of the question was about this whole idea of taking a side or not.
Yeah, yeah.
And the neutrality thing, which, you know, has always really preoccupied me in terms of Sweden and Scandinavia and
Switzerland in the middle.
That's right. So, you know, I think I said somewhere that I'd always been pretty chuffed, you know, as a younger person to think that part of my bloodline had come from a place that didn't take part in armed conflict. But it wasn't until really I researched this book and realised how contested a notion that idea is. And I'd known it anyway as a journalist, you know, as a full-time journalist, that, you know, there came a time when I knew there were things I could no longer take a side on, that I had to be able to write the way I wanted to write those things. So that personal objectivity thing and the political neutrality thing was something I really wanted to work out, I guess. So that was, I had big questions around that. I really didn't know where I was going with that idea. How can you, how do you position yourself about not taking a side on something when there's a moral imperative, especially, which I think there was in Sweden? I know they, you know, I think I found what I found out and I think I came down on the side of them. They did do, there were actions they took which were admirable, but there was a moral imperative here. There was a Holocaust.
Yeah.
And they stayed neutral. So there was that that I had, and I couldn't work that out until the 5 years was up. I had to really just really go into that and all its nuance, I suppose. And part of that was the glass, I have to say, that making Axel a glassmaker, you know, glass is looks like such a neutral substance, but in fact it's not. It's, you know, I think Kerry talks about this in Oscar and Lucinda, I think. Again, another book I couldn't actually reread until later. But I think, yeah, and I'd heard stories about, it's a lovely myth and mythology around glass in terms of, there was a beautiful story about Susie Orbach talks about a young woman in the 1800s who thought she'd swallowed a glass piano, a grand piano made of glass, and she was a princess in her castle, walking up a hallway, trying not to bump because she was terrified of it shattering. And what this meant at a psychotherapeutic level, I think, you know, what is that thing inside us that we're really afraid of shattering? What are we trying not to touch the sides of? Because what will it mean if that glass shatters? And I think what I learned by writing the book was, and I think it's our original role in this country, you know, what we did here as non-Indigenous people, what we did when we arrived here, the slaughter and the displacement that we now turn away from and try to see in a different way. I think I decided that that's what our piece of glass, internal glass, is, that if we look at it, if we shatter it, what will happen to us? Who will we be? And I also think it's part of why we do what we do with people who are refugees who come to us for shelter. I think there's part of us somewhere at a cellular level that knows what we're capable of, that we're capable of what we did in 1770 and onwards, and that maybe these new people might be capable of doing that to us.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a little bit far-fetched even as I say it, but there's something I think that we're very frightened of.
There's a definite consciousness. You see it in politics, you see it in writing of that, a turning away from it because it's just too complicated, too dark. But I'm hopeful right now. There's a lot of great writing and a lot of great work being done. There, where they're pretty much, there's nowhere to turn. You have to see.
There is.
And it is brilliant.
Yes. Yeah, it's entirely there. And I'm involved with an organisation called Sisters Inside that advocates for women in prison. And so, of course, the Nauru and Manus Island stuff, it crosses all boundaries. It's exactly, we imprison people for the same reasons. It's about fear, not about the person, the population being bad. It's what we've done to create these sections of society who have no opportunity, who have no way of living unless they, live in a certain way. And we're all responsible for that. Mm. I mean, I guess there's this tiny proportion of people who have some difficulties that make them behave in certain ways. But most women in prison have either been sexually abused or can come through terrible dispossession themselves, terrible displacement, poverty. They have, they have very few choices in life. And it's very much the same sort of situation, of course, that we are so afraid of the other that we can't look it in the eye.
Well, Ben and I will join you at the barricades.
Excellent.
As soon as we hear the call, we're running.
I'll look forward to that.
Yeah. Christina, thank you so much for coming and talking about this. This book has so much in it, and I'm really excited for Australians to get hold of it and read it and make it their own.
Thank you.
Because I think, I mean, not only will it be bought and sold at Christmas because it's so damn gorgeous.
It is lovely.
It opens up so much to discuss.
Yes, so much to talk about.
Oh,
so
I hope
reading
so.
Groups around Australia and libraries and the rest of it, we'll be talking about this for a long time.
I'd love that.
I'm going to keep you busy.
Yes, I'd love that too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. And you can get hold of a copy of Michelle at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.